All right, we're going to reconvene the Senate Interim Committee on Health Care and Human Services. And the first person on the agenda, Janet Byrd, Kenny LaPointe, and Martha McLennan on housing and its role in the health of Oregon communities. A primer.
Good afternoon, Senator Manas Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Janet Byrd. I am the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and I convene the Housing Alliance, which is a coalition of organizations across the state concerned with housing affordability and housing resource. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today and speak with you about the intersections of housing and healthcare. We are at a time, you just had a lot of opportunity to experience the transformation and change going on in our state systems, and we appreciate the opportunity to talk about the importance of the housing system and the state's role in that. We know, first of all, that housing needs are not being met across communities in Oregon and across the spectrum of housing needs, from people with very, very low incomes to people looking for home ownership opportunities. One of the things that I submitted electronically with my testimony is some material that the Housing Alliance prepares before each long legislative session that documents how we're falling short county by county in Oregon in meeting housing needs. I also submitted a research brief that was prepared by the Center for Housing Policy that summarizes research on how housing contributes to healthy individuals and healthy communities. And the research kind of all across the board documents that the benefits of stable, decent, and affordable housing include things like reduced stress, which improves medical outcomes, decreased asthma because of better environmental conditions, and an increased ability to overcome health challenges. My colleagues with me today will provide some specific examples of how they're working to make sure that housing does contribute to those health outcomes. I'm going to focus my comments kind of on a broad overview level of what the state role is in ensuring housing opportunity and housing affordability across the state. And so you have both electronically and in a handout a summary document that provides just a graphic overview and a very brief summary of how we work to ensure housing opportunity across Oregon as a state. Basically, we can summarize pretty much everything that we do in three categories. We work to build housing opportunity, build housing. We work to preserve existing housing, and we work to increase access. So building is where a lot of the focus goes. It's where a lot of the state resources and financial tools go. Essentially, it's creating new units, rehabbing units for specific use or to reach specific affordability targets. Our goal, obviously, as a state, is to have housing that meets needs at all income and price levels, that is suited to the specific medical needs of individuals and communities. And again, that whole gamut of housing opportunity, all the way from just basic shelter, getting people out of homelessness, off the streets, all the way towards providing affordable home ownership that leads to the ability to build assets over time. Another key strategy that we focus on is not going backwards, so preserving the housing resources that we have, maintaining the housing stability of individuals who are currently stable in housing or stable within a home. one of the kind of, again, sort of in the summary, one of the things that we look at also is making sure that we don't lose matching resources that might be coming. So there's been a large emphasis at the state level on preserving housing that brings in federal rent payments as a match and guarding that precious resource towards affordability. On increasing access, we work very hard to reduce barriers. This is where we think about how we work to leverage the activities of the private market and create incentives or other mechanisms to help the private market function better for all Oregon communities. When we get down into the specifics, what I've listed on each of these documents is both the categories of the ways that the state works to support affordable housing, and I've listed some specific funding mechanisms. I won't go into all of those. Funding mechanisms range, though, kind of across the gamut from direct general fund investment to tax credit initiatives. Oregon has a couple of really unique tax credits that help build and preserve affordable housing. The Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is a pretty unique mechanism that's been in place for a number of years. We also have a lot of statutory tools, so enabling legislation that allows local governments to make choices and decisions about supporting housing affordability. So property tax enabling legislation is the best, most commonly recognized example of that. All of these tools are used not in isolation, but are commonly layered. You know, many, many, many kinds of tools are used to get to creating housing opportunities. Senator Monis Anderson, I know that you're on the board of a nonprofit solutions that has done a pretty remarkable job of that in many of their own developments. Preservation of affordable housing, again, this is a range of tools focused on both preventing homelessness and displacement, preserving manufactured home parks and the housing opportunity that provides, preserving existing affordable housing that brings in those federal rent subsidies or other subsidies, and foreclosure mitigation and working, again, to keep people stable in their homes. And then finally, as we think about opportunities to increase access, one of the bills passed in the 2013 legislative session that focused on how we improve the utility of the rent subsidy program, the Section 8 program, that's an example of that sort of strategy, working to ensure that fair housing obligations are met. And then increasingly, the Housing Alliance is also starting to look at how do we partner with the private market to increase housing affordability, and we're actually hoping to come back to you in 2015 with some new ideas and creative solutions to how we can move forward. So that's a quick overview of just some of the strategies, and I'm going to let Mr. LaPointe and Ms. McLennan talk to you about some specific examples of how this work happens.
Great.
Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Kenny LaPointe, and I'm the Housing and Resident Services Director for the Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority. We're the largest affordable rental housing provider in our region. We serve Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson County. We operate the region's Section 8 program, the Housing Choice Voucher Program. We administer over $7.5 million in rent assistance on an annual basis to Central Oregonians. We also own and operate around 675 units of affordable housing, provide home ownership opportunities and case management services around self-sufficiency. Our role is critical in stabilizing households so that they can focus on education, employment, and health-related outcomes. Recently, we came across an opportunity with our CCO to submit an application that would allow us to administer a pilot project, a rental assistance pilot project called Health Through Housing. This project would operate similar to a program in Portland called JOIN, which you may be familiar with, would provide rent assistance and case management to approximately 20 households for around 12 to 18 months. Outcomes would be tied to health, which I believe you saw earlier, the target of a 2% decrease in Medicaid costs. That's our main goal in that. We anticipate that we would be able to exceed that by a significant amount. There's actually a program operated in Orange County, California right now that was funded through their CCO, and they've seen a 57% decrease in Medicaid reimbursement costs since the inception of that program, which is fairly significant. Other significant outcomes would be related to housing stability and then just other public systems like usage of police department, fire department services, and some of the main targets we're looking at homeless families or individuals who have complex medical conditions, possibly pregnant moms who are homeless. It's assumed that a mother who is pregnant and homeless will have a premature birth, which is a high cost to Medicaid. So I believe the average cost is somewhere around $120,000, $150,000 for a premature birth. So that's one of our main targets there. I'm also, from a personal standpoint, I have a child who was recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And I just know from my experience in the last 6 months with the disease that if my family was homeless, I would most likely be in the emergency room, I would say on a weekly basis at best. So as you can imagine, the cost on the system for somebody who has diabetes who is homeless can be fairly high. Monitoring insulin intake, keeping insulin in a state that you can still use it while being homeless is fairly tough. If you're in hot weather conditions, or tonight in Central Oregon, I think it's supposed to be 15 degrees, so your insulin would most likely freeze in that type of situation. So the cost savings would be pretty significant. We're also working with Mosaic Medical in our area to provide an on-site medical clinic at one of our largest affordable housing properties, which has 167 units. We've surveyed the residents of the property to find out what their needs are related to medical services, and we've determined that this would be a great place to pilot that type of project. And so we're looking at the beginning of 2014 to set up a one-day-a-week medical clinic. Since the time of talking about this with Mosaic Medical, we've had interest from DHS in also setting up an on-site service center there as well, which would provide some case management, access to benefits, program-related referrals, all that type of stuff. That's basically what I have.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Ron Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit with headquarters in Milwaukee. We provide affordable housing statewide, and we provide homeless services in Clackamas County. Kenny has given you some really great examples of ways that housing and healthcare can interact, and they are really at the front edge of that. What we know is that we know where these people live, and so there's a great opportunity to improve health education, health access, and to support people in healthy lifestyles, healthy eating, active living kinds of programs. There are a variety of players in the affordable housing world. Janet started with a little bit of the background on what...
Can you move your microphone a little bit further away?
Further away. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
We know a little bit about what the financing tools are. As Janet mentioned, they are definitely layered. The state's funding is typically a relatively small portion of an affordable housing project, but it is a critically important one. And the players that are involved in this work are varied and do different kinds of work. So my organization as a nonprofit is an active housing developer, a homeless service provider. Other organizations may be economic development providers, employment program providers, education providers, mental health or addictions recovery providers. So quite a mix. There are also roles for our community action agencies, some of whom are housing providers, and our housing authorities, some of whom are housing developers in the affordable world, as well as fulfilling their function in the federal government. So that's a little bit about the roles. What I've given you today is a few stories. I wanted to help you kind of see the names and faces of some of the people that we serve. So the first story that I've provided is about Jessica and her family. I provide this story because this is a family experiencing homelessness. And watching that family go through a continuum of services in our programs, from homelessness to transitional housing and then into permanent housing in one of our properties. The primary state resource that we used in this particular case is the emergency housing account, so a critical component. When we're dealing with homeless families, as Kenny alluded, we are often seeing people with chronic health conditions. The rate of chronic health conditions in our homeless families, and either the adults or the children, is extraordinarily high. One of the things that we don't quite know is which came first, the health condition or the homelessness. So how those two dynamics in a person's life feed upon one another. But we know that stabilizing their housing can stabilize their health, and that's incredibly important. The next story is about Cleason. Cleason lives at our Creekside Woods property. This was a property that was developed with the support of the city of Wilsonville after the loss of the Thunderbird Mobile Home Park. And when that park closed, more than 200 senior households were displaced. With the city's help and the state's help, we were able to rebuild 84 units, and Cleason was one of the people who moved back into that property. He had been displaced to Sherwood. He'd been living in Wilsonville for decades and then displaced to Sherwood when the park closed and was able to come back to the Wilsonville community. One of the things that's really nice about that property, it's immediately adjacent to a community center, has Loaves and Fishes, has recreation programs. So again, a lot of opportunities at that site for healthy lifestyles. When we provide affordable housing, one of the things that the state requires us to do is to provide resident service coordination. And at our senior properties, over 50% of our engagement with seniors is about health. And that might be health access issues. So, for example, we are often helping seniors find an affordable place to get dentures or eyeglasses. It might be health education, where we bring in nursing students who come and help people learn more about managing chronic conditions or their medication management. Or it might be just health and wellness, Tai Chi classes, yoga classes, opportunities like that. The third story that I brought to you is about Matt. Matt is a resident of Hawthorne East. This is an example of a preservation project, the kind that Janet talked about, where there is federal rent assistance that's critically important to make those units affordable. Matt suffers from a degenerative vision condition and is losing his sight and his ability to have affordable housing and be in a community that has great community amenities, great transportation access, really supports in his ability to live independently. So that's just a few of the names and faces, a little bit more example on the ground of the kind of things that we do with the state's resources to support affordable housing. And with that, I think all of us would take questions if you have any.
Well, Senators, the reason I felt really, I felt that this was really important because as we're going through our health care reform for our, in our coordinated care organizations, this is part of, I see as part of the wraparound services that our coordinated care organizations need to be very cognizant of. And I, you mentioned that you were with which CCO?
Pacific Source Health Solutions is ours in Central
Oregon. Okay. And so I will be very interested to see what inroads you do with the other CCOs statewide, because this is a part of what keeps a person healthy. So thank you so much. Any questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'd like to call Len Bergstein, Catherine Sandstrom, and Jeff Katz on Oregon Telemedicine. And colleagues, this is a concept that may be considered a committee bill in our committee.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, thanks very much for having us come today to talk about an exciting topic of telemedicine. We'll jump right into it. Obviously, all the work you've done in reform, telemedicine can be an important tool to help continue to increase the access to care and drive down the cost. My name is Len Bergstein, and I'm going to turn this over to Jeff Katz, who is our medical director, and then Kit Sandstrom, who is in charge of the clinic in Multnomah Village.
And always proceed with start with stating your name. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Jeffrey Katz. Thank you for having us here today to discuss these critical issues that directly impact healthcare access, quality, and reimbursements, really the most important healthcare challenges of our time. I'm a board-certified family physician, and I've been in medicine for the last 17 years, and I've been the medical director of Zoom Care for the last 7 years, back when we only had one clinic in 2006. We now have 17 clinics across just Portland Metro alone, from Salem to Vancouver. Regardless of where a visit occurs, at the end of the day, we still care for patients. We use our training and intellect to solve a patient's health problems. We listen, we take a history, we diagnose, we prescribe, and we cure. The biggest change with technology is simply that technology has now allowed us to do this while the provider and the patient are in different rooms. In fact, a telemedicine visit is not all that different than the old-time, old-fashioned house call, with maybe just two big exceptions. We still get to see the patient in their own home and can learn a lot about their circumstances. But instead of a doorbell, we have a computer chime. And instead of getting paid with a couple of chickens and a bag of grain, we prefer to be reimbursed with more traditional methods. Why is telemedicine important to the practice of modern medicine? Well, the primary technology for telemedicine has been around for quite some time, but it was limited by the expense and the inaccessibility of that equipment, and its growth was actually stunted. But then enter Skype and FaceTime and a variety of other free, high-definition video conferencing tools to which everyone with an internet connection has access. And you take that ubiquitous technology, you repurpose it, and you add new value to it, and you start to improve lives with it. And so many diagnoses are reached by simply listening to patients, seeing them, making eye contact with them, carefully hearing their stories, and seeing them in their own surroundings. We believe that telemedicine improves access. It improves healthcare access from two different angles. Number one, it expands the number of access points. And number two, it removes barriers. Current barriers include geography, transportation, the primary care provider shortages, as you probably are all aware. And as you can imagine, video over internet bridges the geographical gaps that exist in rural Oregon. These home or office visits avoid time away from work and time spent fighting traffic, and allows for care anytime and anywhere. It's impossible, as you can imagine, to staff a doctor's office with a nurse and receptionist at 2 a.m. But a provider can be on call via Skype from home at any time. And it better addresses the shortages of high-quality providers by using technology. We can fill the gap by connecting patients to the right provider at the right time. And for those patients who really do need an in-person visit, we reserve the exam room for those conditions that require the exam. We fundamentally believe that a visit is a visit. The bottom line is that great health care can be provided remotely, and we need to be compensated for it. For example, if I see a child with chickenpox over video, should I not get paid to make the same diagnosis? And by using telemedicine, I've just prevented unnecessary spread of the virus. I've saved a child from infecting an entire lobby full of kids. I've saved a parent from getting varicella pneumonia, a serious condition for adults. And I made it easy for that child to get the right health care. Now, the Oregon Medical Board has been involved since the beginning. In 2011, we sat with the Oregon Medical Board on a number of occasions and walked them through step-by-step what we're doing. We shared with them the same data that we used to determine which conditions could be effectively treated over Skype, and we've identified over 32 supportive studies about the initial 16 conditions that we treated. In addition, there's over 100 supportive studies about telepsychiatry. We shared all of our protocols and red flag criteria with the Oregon Medical Board. Further, we're currently in a research study through OHSU to evaluate the appropriateness of care provided, the safety and scope of care and outcomes. In fact, the vice chair of the OMB is participating in the study. Safety. Allow me to discuss safety. It's safe. An in-person physical exam is absolutely essential for some conditions. And in other cases, it's of no value. Who decides this? The provider does. And how is that decided? Well, in these ways, and I'll list them. Number one, by asking carefully chosen questions that rule out red flags. We have a checklist that the physician leaders of our company selected. And when all negative, the patient's condition does not warrant an exam. These are based on scientific evidence and clinical common sense. Number two, you'll notice that telemedicine services are ordinarily grouped into three different buckets. Either number one, telepsychiatry or mental health. Number two, primary care, issues not requiring a physical exam. And number three, those serious or potentially life-threatening diseases like stroke and neonatal care. Those are provided at Providence and OHSU currently. ZoomCare is providing care for minor primary care issues and minor mental health issues. Number three, we have a network of, as I mentioned, 17 clinics between Salem and Vancouver. We're open every day of the week, and we have at least one clinic open every day of the year. We open early, and we stay open until midnight on weekdays. And so if a telemedicine visit needs to be converted into an in-person visit, there's ample opportunity for that to occur. Number four, we start with the right people delivering these visits. All providers that work at ZoomCare must pass an oral clinical exam prior to hire. We believe we're the only healthcare company in the country that's doing this. And only about 30% of those that take this test are actually able to pass and become ZoomCare clinicians. We have a safety system that's well-developed. Our providers go through extensive training and onboarding. In addition to that, there are 4 hours of required Zoom University in-person training every single month. And providers at ZoomCare complete ongoing quizzes and CME. And they receive feedback on their chart reviews, including telemedicine visits. There's monthly bedside teaching with a physician leader in the company, and there's clinical support via our on-demand clinical hotline. And these things do not exist really anywhere else that we've seen. Lastly, let me highlight the importance of telemedicine as a force for innovation and positive change, putting the patient in the center of the care model and the business model. From a professional point of view, I'm convinced that telecare can provide patients with safe access to high-quality care by linking the patient directly to the provider with these new technologies. Additionally, by adopting a clear public policy supporting and encouraging reimbursed telemedicine, Oregon can continue to show leadership in healthcare reform, and attract the best minds who will invent the ways and new technological means to implement that forward-thinking, patient-centered care. Thank you.
Chairman Mona's Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for your opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Catherine Sandstrom, and I'm a family nurse practitioner. I work at the Zoom Care Clinic in Multnomah Village, and I've been conducting telemedicine visits via an online video conferencing platform called Skype since I joined Zoom Care in 2012. Dr. Katz just spoke to you today about how telemedicine is a safe and effective way to deliver healthcare. And I just want to take some time to discuss with you some of the exciting projects that are going on around the country that use telemedicine. Currently, 43 states cover telemedicine services provided to Medicaid patients. And by 2015, 20 states will require that private insurers reimburse for these visits as well. At least 9 of these 20 states specify that these visits should be reimbursed in an equal manner to traditional in-clinic visits. Many states have employed telemedicine to eliminate healthcare disparities when delivering healthcare to patients in rural areas. This has been consistently a challenge to people in rural areas to seek primary care and to get consultations with specialists. And telemedicine has been a very effective way to eliminate some of these barriers. One project that's gotten a lot of international attention is Project ECHO, which is led by the University of New Mexico Medical School. It's gotten international funding. It's been funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It recently won a grant from the Department of Health and Human Services. And to give you an overview of the cost savings effects of this technology, the grant from HHS is $8.5 million over 3 years, and it's expected to save about $11 million. So this is an example of how you're delivering more health care, but netting a financial gain. Oregon, along with multiple states, including California, Colorado, and Louisiana, has started to employ telemedicine to deliver care to prison inmates. This is significant because there's a lot of cost associated with transporting prisoners and providing security. So by 2010, California had already saved $13 million in transportation and security costs alone by using telemedicine to deliver health care. Another area that Dr. Katz touched on a little bit is using telemedicine to provide mental health services. And this is an area of interest because a lot of times mental illness itself can provide a lot of barriers to patients to seeking health care. The Department of Veterans Affairs has seen how beneficial this technology has been. There is a significant stigma that stands in the way of veterans seeking health care, and this has really helped to eliminate that. Veterans in rural areas are actually able to participate in support groups via video conferencing to discuss mental illness, which they would hesitate to do in a small community regarding concerns for their privacy. So the VA also estimates that it has saved about 800,000 miles in unnecessary transportation by using telemedicine. On a local note, Zoom Care delivers everyday primary care services via an online video conferencing platform called Skype. And Dr. Katz let you know that we treat some mental illness and also primary health concerns like urinary tract infections, sinusitis via Skype. This improves timeliness of care, outcomes, safe costs of transportation and missed work, and also unnecessary ER visits. And we follow guidelines that prompt us to convert the visit to an in-clinic visit when medically necessary to gather data from a physical exam. Now, I can sit here and tell you personally how delighted my patients are at these visits. They're smiling at the end of them. Sometimes they giggle at how easy it was for them to access health care. But you certainly don't have to take my word for it, and I was delighted to read an article in the Portland Business Journal last week that cited some statistics regarding Portland's telemedicine platform, which is called Healthcare Express. Now, they deliver medical visits to their patients without having their patients leave the workplace. One of the employers that does this is Portland Gas and Electric. When they asked their patients what they thought about the telemedicine visits, 80% of them said it was better than a traditional in-clinic visit. So
I certainly hope you have the opportunity to win your re-elections by 80%. And if you do, you know that you should continue doing what you're doing. That's a pretty good mandate. In addition to that kind of staggering statistic, about 70% had it helped them avoid a visit to the emergency room. So not only are you delighting patients, but you're significantly decreasing costs and lowering that burden on people in the emergency room. Unfortunately, at this time, because of the language in the Oregon telemedicine law, a lot of people who have private insurance are still not able to access this technology. So certainly people who pay, who are willing to pay out of pocket, we can serve via Skype, but for people with private insurance, it's still a significant barrier for them. So thank you again for the time this afternoon, and I certainly hope you'll consider fostering this innovation in healthcare as one of your legislative initiatives this year.
Questions? Yes. Senator Steiner Hayward.
We've had the opportunity to speak on occasion before about this issue, and you know that in general I'm very supportive of it. My concern is that this is part of a longer conversation that we've been having about how we pay for health care, right? And you're absolutely right. This is a great way to deliver certain kinds of health care. And if this is the only thing we can do to change how we pay for health care, I'm going to support it. But I worry that if we continue to piecemeal how we transform how we pay for health care and what we're paying for, that we're not really addressing the core problem. ZoomCare is offering primary care now, but it's still on a fee-for-service basis as far as I understand. Am I right about that?
That's true for now, right? But we are.
So anyway, the long story short is the more we have to perpetuate a fee-for-service model, which making this change will do, although it will change how we deliver it and will certainly improve accessibility, and I agree with all of that. It's more of a philosophic statement, I guess, than anything else, but I'd be interested to hear about anything else ZoomCare is thinking about how it might go about changing that model overall.
Senator, I'd like to be able to answer that, if I may. And members of the committee, I think that my take on that issue is that I agree with you that this is not solving all of healthcare's problems, but I think that it solves some of them. I think it does improve healthcare access, and I think that it does avoid emergency room visits. And as you all know, it's about a $500 ticket just to walk into the emergency room, and the costs go up dramatically from there. It's really impossible to leave the ED without a $2,000 bill, almost impossible. And so we are very interested at ZoomCare in improving access and making healthcare easy and excellent and innovating and using innovations to bring healthcare to everybody in the state of Oregon at a much lower cost. We feel this is one of those ways that addresses it.
I would like to point out a couple of issues that, first of all, we don't like to have anything controversial in the February session, number one. I'm sure the insurers would not like this unless there's some great collaboration. Another issue is telemedicine, I don't believe, is covered under our essential benefits package, I believe. Yeah. And so the cost of that would be thrown on our general fund dollars. And so those are some of the issues that I am concerned about. I would love for, I don't know if the Health Evidence Review Commission would looked at this to see the evidence, because we're so focused on evidence-based outcomes. And so those are some of the issues that that just come to my mind right now.
Madam Chair, could I just ask you a question about what you just said? My understanding about things that were covered, and I want some clarification, so maybe somebody can help me out about this one. Jen, I see you nodding your head. Thank you. I thought that the essential benefits and the required benefits had to do with the kinds of care that were delivered, not the way care is delivered. I see Dr. Smith nodding her head over there. Some of you, when you guys come up, you can add a comment about this. But I'd be surprised. I'm not disagreeing with you, but if we're providing diabetes care, my understanding is that group visits, for example, could be covered as opposed to one-on-one visits or, you know, things like that. So I would appreciate some information, Ms. Newell, if I could, about how we could...
informational.
Yeah, that whether that really would become an issue with this or not. Unless there's somebody in the room who actually knows the answer to this question for sure. I see a hand waving in the back. Madam Chair.
If you get down to the eventuality of global budgets, then it's irrelevant.
Right. But that's when you get to the point where we're talking about how we pay for health care in general. But in this case, it would strike me as being, you know, if I have a patient that I'm seeing for a urinary tract infection and I can diagnose her over the phone or over Skype, then it's got to be cheaper. For everybody,
which would be the driving force at that point.
Right, but I mean, I don't know why that wouldn't be covered if treatment for a UTI is covered. I guess my biggest concern is the security issue.
Tell me more about your question.
I'm sorry, I was asking a question out of turn, Madam Chair.
Yeah, that's
okay. I'm worried about security. I mean, Skype, I mean, how are we ensure that people's conversations, you know, you walk into my office, you walk into my exam room, or I walk into your exam room, and we presumably are not being bugged, and I know that my records are confidential.
Yes.
If I'm having a conversation with you about Skype, how confident can we be that nobody's listening in or that information, you know, or FaceTime or something like that? How confident can we be about the security of that for patient confidentiality?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking that. And I think that members of the committee, the answer to that is that this has actually been well studied, and that we know that Skype, for example, uses a two-way encryption so that it cannot be intercepted from either end. And in fact, FaceTime is actually HIPAA compliant.
Oh, so, FaceTime's HIPAA compliant?
That's right.
Well, that's useful information. I didn't know that.
Yes.
How cool is that?
I've got that on my phone and everything.
Yes, you do. So but your doctor has to have it, too.
Why? Do you have it?
Of course I have it.
Well, there we go.
But I'm not your doctor, Cruz. No matter what you think, I'm not your doctor.
But, you know, this was just to... I don't want to take any more time because we've run out of time, but I wanted you to hear about this. There are a lot of people that are interested in this, and there may be a bill that will... you know, come forward out of this as a committee bill, out of our committee. And so this is our first stab at it, and there'll be some more research that will need to be done on this topic. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. With that, I would like to call Dr. Janine Smith, Dr. Lisa Dotson, and Dr. Sam Saha. They're going to be talking about the proposed coverage guidance for self-monitoring glucose. And colleagues, as they came up, I want to make sure that you know that in OLIS, and we don't have it in our packet, do we? That there is in the Diabetic Association some...
It's not yet in OLIS, but...
Yeah, it's not yet in OLIS, but they wanted to make sure that they... we're on the record of not really being in favor of any changes with the test strips, diabetic test strips. So, take it away.
Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm Janine Smith. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the Oregon Health Authority and oversee through my Office of Health Policy the staffing of the Health Evidence Review Commission. I'm accompanied today by two wonderful members of our Volunteer Health Evidence Review Commission, Dr. Saha, who is the chair of the overall commission, Dr. Dodson, who will introduce herself as well, who is not only on the full commission but chair of the committee that first wrestled with this, one of their subcommittees. So I'm going to turn it over, and each have are going to kind of fill in their parts and then open it up to your questions.
Okay, Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Sam Saha. I'm a primary care physician
I work at the VA Medical Center in Portland and at OHSU, and as Janine said, I'm chair currently of the Health Evidence Review Commission, and my job is going to be just to give a little bit of an overview of what the HERC does and how we came to this topic that we're talking about today. So the HERC, as you probably already know, is a group of health professionals and consumer and patient representatives that are all volunteers, and basically our job is, as our title states, to review evidence about health. Really, to make healthcare delivery in the state of Oregon as evidence-based as possible. So, you know, in a nutshell, our job is to really comb through what we do in the healthcare sector and to try to figure out what works and what doesn't work. And one of our major principles is that if we are going to infuse taxpayer dollars into our healthcare system, we should be trying to infuse them in a way that gets the most health out of our investment. So with that sort of charge, we do a few things. One is that we develop evidence-based guidelines for usually sort of big ticket clinical topics to try to help inform both clinicians and patients what the evidence says about the best way to deliver care, what holds the most value in terms of improving health. We develop coverage guidance for people who are responsible for making coverage decisions to basically give them some information about what the evidence says is kind of going to be the going to offer value for the investment in health. And then our third charge is to manage the prioritized list of health services, which is, as you know, the benefits package for the Oregon Health Plan. So we in our management of the prioritized list, we in 2006 we as you may know, we reprioritized the list, which was developed initially in the early 90s. We went through a reprioritization effort, and during that reprioritization effort, we really focused on, you know, kind of what are the most important things that we're doing now in healthcare in the 21st century. And in that reprioritization, we really pushed a lot of the chronic illnesses that seem to be sort of the big ticket topics in healthcare to the top of the list. So diabetes really rose to the top during that period. We made diabetes a high priority. Type 1 diabetes, out of our list of 600 plus conditions, type 1 diabetes is ranked number 10. Type 2 diabetes is number 33. These are very big ticket topics. And over the course of the last few years, we have reviewed things, evidence around services to improve how we care for diabetes, how we support patients in managing their own diabetes. In 2010, we reviewed nutritional support, and we made coverage decisions about nutritional support. In 2011, we reviewed self-management training services to help people manage their chronic illness better, and we decided to cover self-management training. Just this year, we looked at the issue of continuous glucose monitoring for certain patients with type 1 diabetes to try to keep even control of their diabetes when they are on continuous insulin infusion, and we made coverage decisions about certain types of patients who qualify for continuous glucose monitoring. So this has been a topic where diabetes we recognize is, you know, one of the biggest health topics for both Oregon and the country, and we've been sort of doing our job to try to comb through what we do to support people's management of their chronic illness and diabetes and try to really sort of sort through the evidence to invest in what is going to be most helpful. So self-monitoring of blood glucose, test strips, as you know, is a big part of diabetes management. And so this came to our commission, and we then basically went about reviewing the evidence about test strips and really looking towards, who, how, when, how much, those kinds of questions. And we sort of carefully looked at the evidence, and Lisa's going to give you a glimpse of what we found.
Oh,
Senator Manas Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Dodson, and I am appearing today in my role as the chair of the value-based benefits subcommittee that reviewed this evidence for the HERC. I want to first, and I know that several of you are healthcare providers, and this will be obvious, but just to remind everyone that type 1 diabetics and type 2 diabetics are different, and that most of the recommendations that we're talking about will apply to only to type 2 diabetics, and that monitoring for type 1 diabetics and for type 2 diabetics who require insulin injections daily are not subject to the restrictions or the reduced number of strips that we are talking about.
So you're saying this is just for non-insulin-dependent?
Non-insulin-dependent diabetics is what is, yes, exactly. So for type 2 diabetics who are not insulin-dependent, and some are, we have reviewed the evidence thoroughly and found somewhat paradoxically or counterintuitively that more frequent testing actually does not improve control of diabetes, that it actually in some cases can worsen control and certainly can worsen quality of life of diabetics. And I know that sounds a little counterintuitive, so I'll briefly explain. The poor quality of life relates to things like high rates of anxiety. When you have a blood sugar that for no apparent reason seems to rise, if you are an insulin-dependent diabetic, you may treat that with a shot of insulin. For non-insulin-dependent diabetics, we don't treat them daily with multiple dosage changes of medication. They're on a fixed dose. It's somewhat similar, if you can think of it, to a person who was on warfarin, which is a medicine for blood thinning. Also equally powerful medicines that need to be monitored, but in no circumstances do we monitor them daily and make minute changes to their regimen. We monitor them on some other frequency. So looking at the sort of sense of futility and some depression symptoms and higher rates of anxiety that can come along with learning of your blood sugar is going up and down within the margins that happen with this population can actually cause poor quality of life for diabetics that do not have the ability or need to change their dosing daily. The evidence also was fairly clear that the treatment of diabetics in this group can safely be managed without daily blood glucose monitoring. There's a mountain of data that we combed through, a very, very large amount. Additional data was provided by all different sorts of public testimony. But our recommendations at the end of the day came, and I'll wrap up just in the interest of time, was that evidence showed that strips were best combined with education. One of our concerns is that when we divert resources to something that we do not have good evidence, we are by definition restricting care in another area. The Oregon Health Plan, as it is structured, is if something moves up the list, something else must move down. So we can get additional resources by adding services to the list. And we are concerned that other effective measures, such as our ability to provide nutrition education, to provide diabetic educators and diet and exercise counseling and things like that, which we know are effective, may be compromised if we are overspending on diabetic strips that do not help with the management of these patients. I'm going to, in the interest of time, stop there and let you ask any questions if you have them.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
First question. How big is the population we're talking about?
Pardon me?
How big is the population we're talking about, the type 2 diabetics that don't require daily insulin?
I don't have the numbers with me. I'm remembering something on the order of 10,000 patients or so. Does that sound right? I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers in front of me.
Okay.
It's a big number.
Huh?
It's a big number. There are a lot of people who have type 2 diabetes who aren't on insulin.
Okay. I guess, Madam Chair, when you say the anxiety and things like that are counterintuitive, I think to a degree, I think your results are counterintuitive. I mean, I don't have diabetes, My grandmother did. She had type 2, and she tested herself on a daily basis, and she had a great deal of comfort in doing that because she knew what she was looking at, and she knew it'd come up and down. But, you're not going to tell me that somebody on type 2 that is on a regular med, their condition can't change and become worse, because it can.
Certainly, and we are not proposing at all that they not be monitored. It's just that home monitoring doesn't really change that situation. There is a need to have blood testing equipment at home for all diabetics for several reasons. Some diabetics are on medications, even though they're not insulin, that can lower their blood sugars under certain circumstances if they haven't eaten, if they're ill, a number of other conditions. We certainly want diabetics to have those test strips available should they develop symptoms so that they can communicate with their healthcare provider and make a decision as to dosing. That does not happen, though, on a daily basis. And monitoring it doesn't change their outcomes. There's very good evidence that we found that frequent monitoring, in some cases at least, causes more anxiety. In some cases, it may be reassuring to patients, but it doesn't change their outcome or improve their hemoglobin A1C or their diabetic complication rate.
But you're talking about education, okay, informing these people of what they have and what they need to do. And then, you have those that feel better if they kind of know on a regular basis, and you're going to restrict them. So to a degree, you could be increasing their anxiety rather than just saying educate them and then whatever, this is, in my family, diabetes was something that was self-monitored, it was taken care of, if changes happen, they go to the doctor, but they, this is somebody kind of being in control of their own health care to a degree, isn't it?
So I guess your point is well taken. So I think that there are two good reasons that you could sort of posit for people who are not on insulin to check their blood sugars. One is if they're going to make some change. So they're going to check their blood sugar, they're going to find out that it's really high, and they're going to do something. People who are on fixed-dose medications, the only change they have is to eat differently. Now, what happens then, and what the evidence has shown, is that generally what that can lead to, not always, but what it very much can lead to is people skipping meals, which is the typical reaction to a very high blood sugar. Skipping meals is a dangerous thing to do if you're on blood sugar lowering medicines. People then end up with a dangerously low blood sugar. They get hypoglycemic. They can have all kinds of acute complications from that. They can pass out. They can have a seizure. And the evidence that we've reviewed has shown that on average, that happens more with more frequent monitoring. So it is people do things to try to manage their blood sugars that do result in harm. But the other side of the coin is that it does not actually improve people's blood sugar control. It might make intuitive sense if you check, then you will improve. But there's no pathway for that improvement, and the evidence shows that they don't really improve significantly their blood sugar control. So you're really just monitoring without a path to changing. And so then, if you take another chronic illness like high blood pressure is something that changes day to day. If people are on a fixed dose medication, there's really not much they can do about it. In general, even though it doesn't cost anything, we don't recommend clinically that people monitor their blood pressure every day. It's micromanagement of a chronic illness. We're talking about an illness that's chronic, where we make changes every few months. And then we're talking about basically checking them every day. There is a micromanagement aspect that I think is what might result in the evidence that we found, which is that it doesn't help, and it might actually, in some cases, not all cases, result in some harm.
Yeah, you can't cure diabetes, but you can, it's a lifetime thing, and you're trying to hit a level playing field, pure and simple.
Right. I was at Kaiser's pharmacy distribution center, and that's just across the street from my district, and so I was talking to them about this, and they said that they have implemented this throughout their Kaiser system, so it's not new, and it was based on research, but that's all I know.
That's correct, and I think We frequently have changes that occur in how we monitor things over medicine as we learn evidence. I think, you know, just again as an example, for many, many years we did pap smears on women every single year from puberty till death, and spent a great deal of money doing that with really, as it turns out, no health benefit, and doing them every 3 years does not produce any worse outcomes, and it saves a dramatic amount of money, and most importantly, actually saves a lot of young women from false positives, which result in lots of testing and anxiety and treatments that they really don't need. So I think, again, this seems very radical, and I think it is very much different from the trend. However, as Senator Mona Sanderson points out, we are not the first people to attempt to do this. It is evidence-based and based on research, and we at the Commission are very cognizant of our duty to utilize public resources in the most effective way possible, and really feel like the evidence in this case points to reduced amounts of testing being the proper thing to do, both from a cost savings point of view, but also from a patient management point of view.
Okay, we need to move on. Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the commission meets next in 2 weeks, and as continuing, so the actual discussion document that they had at their last meeting, those aren't necessarily their final recommendations. They are taking under advisement all of this information and input, and will be deciding.
Can you make sure that they get a copy of what the American Diabetes Association? And Representative White, do you want to say a few words?
What's the projected savings?
The Health Evidence Review Commission primarily looked at this because there was concerns about this from the medical directors of the CCOs and other providers and the program, fee-for-service program. The commission doesn't actually look at what it would save or not save. They look at the evidence, and they look at certain, when they look at choosing a topic, it's more if there's an interest in them wanting to look at the evidence, and there maybe it's a cost driver, but it's not that. I don't have on me at this moment what any potential savings would or not be, because their final decision has not been made in terms of what they're going to recommend for guidance. And then the CCOs can proceed to do what they wish to do. This, again, this is a guidance, and they can choose inside their global budget how they spend those dollars.
Okay, we don't have much time, so Representative Widener, please make it brief, but welcome.
Be quick and brief.
There was somebody looked just like him in that room over there.
Amazing. I didn't get enough questions out, and I missed you guys.
So. We missed you too, Representative.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, I popped over here because I saw this up on the agenda and heard a few things, but State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, encompassing Yamhill and Washington County. And I popped in because this is something that hits me personally, because I have a stepfather who's type 2 diabetic, I have a father-in-law who's a type 2 diabetic, and a son who's a type 1 diabetic. So I know the issues very well, and the most important thing you can do to keep costs down is testing. So I've had to deal with the emergency calls where I've had a father-in-law or a stepfather out cutting the grass at a cemetery, and it's like, hey, my blood sugar's low, I don't want to startle your mom, can you bring me something, because he can't drive or anything, and starts getting there, and you're rushing to get something, you know, because he can feel it coming on. And he tests basically once a day to see what he should be eating, because he tries to control his diet, and it actually helps him control his diet and eat properly by doing the testing. It also helps the doctor out when they can see, because it keeps what your blood sugar has been over time, to see if they're getting the proper dosage of the insulin, if they are taking insulin, or if they're just doing it once a week, once a month. We found with testing and everything, my stepfather has been able to control his. My father-in-law, on the other hand, lost his kidneys. He's on dialysis and other limbs because things weren't monitored well when he was younger, and he went too long without monitoring and testing and didn't do it till later in life, but too much damage was already done at this point. And as I was sitting back here listening to it, I mean, it sounds like this is the beginning of death panels that we're listening to when we're looking at taking away testing strips, the very thing that diabetics need to basically tell them how they need to eat, what they need to do as a type 2 diabetic. And what's next when we go to type 1s? Are we going to say you only test 3 times a day? That's the max. My son, 18 years old, he wrestles. He cuts weight for wrestling. He has to monitor 6-7 times a day. Because he'll do it a couple times at practice, lots of times. He's on a pump. Every time he eats, he needs to know where things are at and setting it there. So if we start here with type 2 diabetics that are on a fixed, what's next? Then we go to the guys who are there regulating themselves, saying you can't test as much and you're just going to give yourself for every meal this much, or you're going to guess how much insulin you need.
That wouldn't be evidence-based. I don't think we'd go there.
Yeah, but I'm... We're opening the door for these type of things to start coming up. So I think this needs to be something between a doctor and the patient. The doctor needs to make this decision. It doesn't need to come from a panel sitting up here, and this is what we think is best for everybody. And I think a doctor's the one who needs to make it individually with each patient that they work with.
Senator Steiner, Hayward, and then we need to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Widener, I really appreciate your perspective, and I appreciate your bringing your experience to this committee. I would say that as a physician myself who manages a lot of diabetics, I don't really have a problem with these guidelines because secondly, as a physician, I don't have time to do all the research myself on really solid evidence. I do not have time to be looking into how often my diabetics need to be testing, and especially when it's very focused. And if I remember, I mean, I saw these guidelines back during September legislative days, I think, too. There was also a possibility for an override if you had a type 2 diabetic who was only on oral medication. I see some heads nodding among our panelists there. So I think there's a lot of leeway for an individual physician to make these decisions with his or her patient if there are unusual circumstances. If I had a new type 2 diabetic, I would certainly expect that as we were adjusting their medications, that I would have the opportunity to have them test much more frequently, and I'm sure that would be the case. I'm also going to be monitoring my diabetics according to the evidence with a hemoglobin A1C test on a regular basis that prevents those long-term complications, and we know that with that's evidence-based as well, that if we do that on a consistent basis at the appropriate intervals, we can prevent the kinds of complications that one of your relatives studied. Suffered from. I understand your concern. As a physician, I don't want the government getting in between me and my patient either, but I do count on people to take hard looks at the evidence, and the track record of the HERC is really, really good in terms of the work that they've done and the evidence that they've reviewed for a whole range of things. So exactly where I'm going to fall on this one, I don't know, but overall, I think they're doing really good work, and I support the work they're doing, and I don't see any evidence of them trying to tell me how to practice.
We need to move on. All right. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you. All right. Let's move on to Lois Day and Stacey Lake, update on Senate Bill 964. And if we could limit it to about 10 minutes, if that's at all possible.
Thank you, Chair Mons and members of the committee. My name is Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director over at the Department of Human Services. We have a PowerPoint. We won't put it up because it's way too long for the time that we have left, but we would like to highlight a few points for you, and if you'll have that PowerPoint if you want additional information, we're always happy to come back or even meet individually if that's what's necessary to answer people's questions. As you're aware, the child welfare system has had an agenda of safely and equitably reducing the number of children who experience foster care for a number of years. And currently we have 3 large strategies that we're implementing in an effort to push that agenda forward. Those strategies are to reinvigorate our Oregon safety model so that statewide we're practicing with fidelity to the model, implementing these service arrays that were outlined in Senate Bill 964, which is the Strengthening, Preserving, and Reunifying Families programs, and also implementing differential response. Specifically today, we'll talk primarily about the Senate Bill 964 service array and our progress with that. And if the time allows, we can talk more about the Oregon safety model efforts and the differential response implementation. There are additional strategies that we're doing. Those are simply the 3 largest ones we want to point out today for this committee. Moving through the PowerPoint quickly. Why don't we move straight to a conversation about the Senate Bill 964. This was a statute passed in 2011, which outlined directed the program to work with counties in a collaborative manner to identify gaps in the service array and create strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families in counties to provide services to individuals that come to the attention of the child welfare program. With me today is Stacy Lake, who is the differential response manager, who also manages the Senate Bill 964 effort. So I'm going to have her speak for a moment around the progress we've made in implementing those programs.
Chair Mons-Anderson, committee members, my name is Stacy Lake. We have at this point put into place services in 8 counties across the state, and we mean to have Senate Bill 964, Strengthening, Preserving, Reunifying Family Services, in place in every county in the state by May of 2014. The idea is for communities to come together and identify the gaps and needs in their communities at addressing the families that are child welfare involved in maintaining children safely at home, getting children home more quickly, providing culturally competent services. All are strategies to help safely, equitably reduce children in foster care. So at this point, we have a visual that just shows the counties that are left for implementation, and it just shows you the schedule, who will be implementing when, and it really just shows when we'll start with an orientation. We go out and we work with the counties, helping them determine how to best do their needs and gaps analysis, who might be best to bring to the table in their communities, and then they do those analyses, and then that just shows to execution of contracts. You can see there's a wide variety of services, and I'm just going to name a few. The relief nurseries, several counties have decided to put in place parent navigators and mentoring services. Several counties have also, actually more than several, have identified housing issues. So we're providing supportive services related to housing stability, drug-free housing, parenting training, and front-end intervention are just some examples of services that are put in place in those counties.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. Chair Anderson and members of the committee, of the counties we've implemented and those that are in the process of identifying the gaps in their service array or in the contracting process, the number one service that these counties are identifying is housing, supported housing, both emergency short-term and long-term housing that has supports in place while families address the larger issues that brought them to the attention of the department. The second service that seems to come most frequently to our attention is some form of navigator or mentoring service that can help families understand and move their way through with success the actual involvement with the greater child welfare system, the court system, the system of services that we have, and the work we do directly with the families. And then the third really are child-centered services such as relief nurseries. And part of what these funds have allowed us to do is to help in some ways build capacities in communities that they can then leverage when other funding sources are found. And the relief nurseries are a perfect example of that, where we can actually fund the nurseries to serve the folks that come to our attention, but there are certainly other families in the community that have similar needs, and our hope is that communities will come together and figure ways to then leverage the existence of that relief nursery into a broader service array for families.
So why the Oregon Safety Model and the Senate Bill 964 services are being talked about and also in relation to the differential response model is because they're all very critical components of a successful implementation of differential response in Oregon, which we anticipate starting in May of 2014 in Lane and Klamath counties. So the reason why the Oregon Safety Model refresh that Ms. Day was just talking about is so important is because that is our practice model. It is a family engagement model. It's critical that we're really strong in our foundational practice model before we try to enhance that through our differential response. The service array, filling the gaps in the service array are also a critical component to a successful implementation of differential response. So these are the three components that we're working hard on at the same time to start differential response in May of 2014.
So there's some additional slides that describe where we are in the process of working towards implementation and being able to actually start utilizing that additional track in May of 2014 that we'll leave for you all to look through. And if there are additional questions, we're certainly open to those. Finally, in the last part of the PowerPoint, you'll see some progress indicators. And what we're able to report is that in the last 5 years, we have had a 8% reduction in the number of children who've entered foster care. We've had an increase in the number of children who are with relatives. We have had an increase in the absence of repeat maltreatment. We have a slight decrease in the absence of maltreatment for children in foster care. What you don't have there on the PowerPoint, I'll give you some additional information around the progress we're making. We've had a reduction of the overall number of children who actually have any foster care experience, a day in foster care, since 2009. And we've increased the number of children when they do have a foster care experience that are in a family foster care setting rather than a residential treatment care setting. And we've increased the number of children that had two or less placements in their foster care experience.
That's a big one.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
And how many years do you think that it will take before we have good data after the implementation in the various counties?
Well, what we hope when we're specifically with the Senate Bill 964 contracts, what we're working with contractors now is we're creating contracts that have outcomes
okay.
rather than outputs in them, and asking our contractors to identify how they'll actually measure those outcomes. We're trying to come to a common language through the Oregon Safety Model, where we're actually looking at the protective capacities that are deficient in parents that create a lack of safety for children, and then having conversation with service providers around how their service will specifically enhance protective capacities. And then we'll be able to, by being able to return children because of enhanced protective capacities, we'll be able to determine the success of individual programs in reaching that outcome.
Because I'll be really interested, I don't know if the committee will, to see how county by county, how successful this is. So great. Yes.
We heard some stuff about this in September, I believe, in a different committee. Can you remind me, at that point we talked about the fact that some of this hadn't actually been fully implemented in 2012. Could you remind me, please, just because the decreases are great, don't get me wrong, but I'm just curious when things really got going. We only passed this in the 2011 session, so when things really got up and running, so what really these changes might reflect in terms of time since implementation? Am I making any sense at all?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, when we met in September, our conversation was around the fact that this legislation had passed and we'd been given some funds for 964 implementation in 2011. And at that time, none of our contracts had been in place for over a year. And so we really are not able to, even at this point, we're not able to attribute our success to these programs. But I believe that with the implementation schedule that we have and the way that we're currently letting our contracts, we will be able to measure individual contractor success in addressing the issues that parents had that were keeping their children unsafe. So I'm hopeful that within the next year we'll be able to bring you very good data around that. We have some programs that are some communities that have chosen to have umbrella organizations versus individual service providers that are working together, such as the OnTrack program. We're very hopeful that with those programs, because we can look at more global outcome measures for that totality of that program, such as return home or keep at home for children, we're hopeful that we'll be able to have some data for you in the next year that really tells us how effective the programs are.
924 was just a further evolution in a direction we've been trying to go for a long time as well. So,
thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. All right. The last thing on the agenda, and I'm going to call Tom Holt, Claudia Black, and Elizabeth Ramley. They all have three different concepts, so I'll come up here and just in a couple of sentences, each gets about a minute and a half, what the concept is and if it's going to be controversial. Because Cruz and I are going to meet hopefully tomorrow. We need to do that to figure out what committee bills we're going to have.
Chair Moss, Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. I'm here to cap your day the way you began it, something that had good intentions in policy but has proved a little difficult on the ground to implement. We had a bill last session, or there was a bill last session that we supported. House Bill 2432 provided for a waiver of cost sharing for pregnant women who have diabetes during their time of pregnancy and immediately postpartum. It turns out there's some flies in the ointment of the language. We support the policy, but there are some technical changes that we would recommend to make it much, much easier for health plans to administer. There is also a really important piece that needs to be changed, and that would be to exempt health savings account plans, because if we were to move forward implementing it as written under federal law, we would be invalidating Oregonians' health savings accounts qualification. And I don't think that was any of our intention.
That wouldn't be a good thing.
I wish that we had been able to catch that during the session, but as this moved rather quickly, we didn't catch that, and I apologize for that. But we have some language in rough draft that we'd be happy to submit through the committee administrator to you to get this going. We don't think this should be controversial. It is truly purely technical.
And I already shared it with Dr. Goldberg, and he just no problems. Okay, who wants to go next? Elizabeth.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Remley here representing the Society of Physician Assistants. The PAs have been working with Senator Monis Anderson on this issue for a while. I think I've met with everybody except Senator Cruz. Sorry, Senator, I'm coming to see you tomorrow. We've had a couple situations this year and last year that have been brought to the attention of the society that have made us realize that we need to make some technical updates to statute. Where physician assistants are currently allowed to provide services, just make it really clear in statute that they are allowed to provide services. There are a lot of places in statute where it'll say a physician or a nurse practitioner may do X. The statutory implication is that a physician assistant may also do that service because their physician is allowed to do it, and a PA may operate under the scope of their supervising physician as long as it's in their practice agreement. However, there are a lot of folks who interpret those statutes in their own context without referring to other parts of statute, and we're having problems, for example, with medical records at hospitals, with certain agencies interpreting statutes a certain way, and PAs are being excluded from their ability to do their job. We've had PAs who have had to spend time chasing down hospital administrators instead of seeing their patients and doing rounds because their health IT system is requiring a co-signature on something they've always been able to do by themselves. This can mostly be addressed by just being really explicit in statute about the fact that a PA is allowed to do something. We're going through
under the
current rules. It's not a scope.
A doctor's
expansion.
A clarification is what you're talking about.
Yes, it's totally a clarification, sort of an omnibus, wherever we can get it without controversy. I invite anybody who is looking at the draft bill once it's ready to come talk to us. If they have problems, we'll just take that section out because we don't really want to deal with anything where we have to have a conversation. We'll wait and deal with that later. The nurse practitioners are also looking at the list. There are a couple places where they may want to be added as well. It just depends on what that looks like. So.
Thank you. Claudia.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm co-director of government relations for Multnomah County. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this legislative.
Can't keep a job for very long.
I know.
She's been in Multnomah County
bad track
for a
record.
While.
What can I say?
Yeah.
I appreciate the fact that you are willing to consider this legislative concept, and also I appreciate the opportunity to explain it to you. This is a bill that was in your committee last session, in the regular session, Senate Bill 457A. I see Mr. Holt looking with a great deal of interest this direction, with the Dash 5 amendments, and so it's essentially the same bill. This was a bill that the Sheriff's Association brought up late in the session. It was still alive in the last couple of days of the session. We were encouraged to bring it up in 2014 by a member. And basically what it is the concept would require that health insurance companies pay for the health care that is provided to people who are insured by them and are incarcerated in county jails. Most, if not all, health insurers have exclusions in their policies for people who are incarcerated. That means that even when the premiums continue to be paid, the insurers will not cover health care costs while the person is incarcerated. Currently, health care for people who are incarcerated in county jails is paid for by the county taxpayers. This concept would remedy that cost shift by requiring health insurers to continue to pay for health care for their insured population, whether that care is provided in the community or in jail. And I will say that I just left the Association of Oregon Counties, and there's a resolution that they're voting on in about half an hour to really support this. The county commissioners are obviously very strongly in support of it. As to the controversial nature of this bill, it certainly has the potential to be controversial. However, I'm hoping that between now and February we can work out some compromises. The language that's in here was a result of a work group that Sandy Teal Circa put together during the legislative session, and it includes a number of the things that the insurers had asked for. I think all but one of them.
I have submitted an LC opinion on what the Affordable Care Act says, and I haven't read the last email from Lori Freeman, but it is in process, and hopefully we'll have that LC opinion soon.
Thank you very much.
So we may not need legislation. We can just do it. All right. Any other comments? Thank you so much for coming and sharing. And Senator Cruz, we need to make sure that our staff makes us meet. With that, we are adjourned.